My name is Gary Joel Schacker. I am the chair of the Technology and Communications Committee. We are very happy to be able to provide you with this presentation this morning. Steve Weichel, if you guys were at this session we had yesterday, you'll know it's going to be pretty impressive. So we're looking forward to it. And Brandon Weber from Hightower, who's a sponsor here, will also be involved in this presentation. So we hope you enjoy it. And with that, I'd like to bring up Steve. Well, bring it up, Brandon. Yeah. Bring it up, Brandon.
Good morning, everyone. I am incredibly impressed to see this room totally full at 9:19. So thank you so much. It's exciting. So I've got the pleasure of not only introducing Steve, but kind of setting the table for him. So I'm going to spend a few minutes talking about change agents in commercial real estate. Some of the what we see is kind of the foundational drivers of why things are kind of changing faster now than maybe they would have 3 or 4 or 5 years ago. And then Steve's going to dig into some of the amazing research that they're doing at MIT into kind of more of the specifics about what is actually changing, what are the new technologies that are being delivered to the commercial real estate industry. Hopefully very practical. We should all be taking notes and kind of takeaways from it. So I'll get started. I'll be down in a few minutes, and then I'm excited to bring Steve up. So I talked a little bit about this yesterday, but I want to elaborate on some of the things that we're seeing. I, at Hightower, as the CEO of Hightower, we're a technology company, and we're building modern technology for commercial landlords, brokers, and property managers. And we think there's a lot of work to be done there. I fly all over the country. I get to talk to some of the biggest institutionals in the world, some of the biggest brokerage firms in the world, and property managers. So I get to see a lot. And here's some of kind of the themes that we're seeing right now. So first one's really that our industry has changed a lot over the last 20 and 25 years. And I'm going to talk about how it's changed. If you think about kind of just investment in commercial real estate, this is a chart showing institutional investment in our industry back in the, you know, the 80s and 90s. If you play that chart to the right, those bars get really, really big. And if you zoom out, this is kind of what institutional investment in commercial real estate has looked like over the last 25, 30 years. And the punchline here is that commercial real estate is institutionalizing as an asset class. I think we're all hearing that a lot. I was just at ULI fall meeting. Everyone's talking about it, and they're talking about the implications of what does it mean to have our industry institutionalizing. So that's a chart showing investment in real estate as part of an institutional portfolio. That number is expected to hit $7 trillion globally this year. Expected to go up by another $600 billion next year. Commercial real estate now represents just over 10% of institutional owner portfolios. About 25 years ago, we represented about 1.5%. So we've gone from this kind of provincial industry to institutional faster than I think a lot of us have thought. And some of the implications there, portfolios are getting larger. There's a lot more complexity in the real estate that we're dealing with. Reporting requirements up the wazoo. I think we feel it on the brokerage side. I think institutional owners feel it on the partner and JV side. Everyone's talking about transparency and visibility and trying to figure out how to get that done. And then finally, we're all expected to do more with less. Owners are expected to grow portfolios and AUM without growing headcount. People on the brokerage side are expected to deliver more insights, more analytics, more sophistication. And these are kind of some of the big things that are changing. The problem is, and I talked about this yesterday for those who are in there, I'll elaborate a little bit, the problem is we're kind of getting held back by tools that haven't changed very much. Excel's really kind of our system of record. I had the opportunity to work at Microsoft on the Excel team building Excel for 4.5 years. It was an amazing experience. I absolutely love Excel. It's like the Swiss Army knife of software. You can do anything in it. But there's a lot of stuff that Excel's not very good at. It's not good at being a database. It's not good at being a collaboration tool for 6 brokers to update a leasing activity report. It's not great for rolling up data across a portfolio of assets. It's got a lot of limitations. And the problem and the reason that we're kind of forced into Excel is we're working with a lot of software that hasn't really evolved too much, right? So when you think about our actual technology, the foundational technology powering the industry, we're looking at some of the big brands here. And those years are actually the founding dates of those companies. So on average, the 4 biggest brands of technology powering commercial real estate are 32-year-old companies, right? MRI was started in 1971. So a lot of these things and kind of, you know, the implications of that are kind of interesting. So these companies matured a long time ago. And, you know, 1994, the Netscape browser was invented. These companies had been around for a long time, making a lot of money, had a lot of customers. And then an entirely new wave of technology has come, cloud computing, mobility, really easy to use software that we call kind of consumerization of IT. And these are kind of waves of innovation that frankly have passed the commercial real estate industry by, or we haven't gotten to access because the technologies that we're kind of using just really haven't dug into that and can take an advantage of that. So that's kind of our challenge and that's our opportunity. And this is my point of view. I believe that the technology that we're being given as practitioners was built for a completely different era. And I think we deserve better. And you know, I think there's billions of dollars of value that is being lost, the opportunity cost that exists because we don't have these tools. And frankly, I think it's just less fun to work in the industry than it should be. This is what software makes us feel like, I think, every day when we're trying to log into stuff, we're trying to make things work. You know, you're kind of pounding your head against a computer trying to get stuff done. I hear the term brain damage almost daily now from customers, from prospects, from people that I talk to at an industry conference. And so we're in the business of changing this. So I'm going to talk about kind of why things are changing and why I think things are going to change a lot faster than people originally would think. And then Steve's going to get to dive into some of the really interesting stuff going on. So I'm going to start with a quote. Has anyone heard of this quote, "Software is eating the world"? By just a show of hands. It's so awesome that only three or four hands were raised, because I think that this is a great opportunity to share this. So Marc Andreessen is the founder of Netscape. He's considered kind of the father of the modern web browser. He's also the founding partner of Andreessen Horowitz, which is regarded to be the world's best institutional venture capital firm right now at this point in time. Investors in Uber, investors in Airbnb, they're really sharp guys. And he made this statement that software is eating the world about 7 or 8 years ago. And his point of view on this was that traditionally most of us in the room would think about software as an industry. There's the software industry, there's the commercial real estate industry, there's the advertising industry. And he says, no, that's all wrong. Over time, software is going to be the technology that powers all industries. Software is eating the world. And I'll give you a couple of examples that should resonate. So transportation and hospitality. These are completely non-software industries, right? Who would have 5 years ago thought that like the taxi industry was like the next thing that we had to disrupt when we're like standing out in front of a street, holding our hand out there. We're like, oh God, I need an app that I can like tap on something and get, you know, have a taxi come to me. No one would have thought of that. That is a completely novel concept. We weren't sitting there banging on the doors of taxi industry saying, you gotta fix this giant problem, right? Same with hospitality. And if you kind of fast forward, you look at companies like Uber and Airbnb, and literally in the span of 5 years, they have completely changed their industries, completely changed. Uber was started in 2009, Airbnb started Q3 of 2008. Uber is now a $36 billion company. They're the world's largest transportation company. Airbnb is a $27 billion company. They're the world's largest hospitality company. And hospitality is not too far away from us. I think some of us in the room, might do work or know folks who do work in the hospitality side of things. So industries can change very, very quickly, and we're seeing technology change not at kind of a linear pace, but at an exponential pace. So the amount of time between major innovations over the last 10 or 15 years is actually dividing. So, from internet to smartphone to tablet, tablet to big data, it's all compressing. So all this stuff is happening right now in commercial real estate. Hightower is just one example of that. In 24 months, we've raised $23 million in capital. I've gone from 0 people to 60 people on my team, and we're all laser focused on doing one thing, which is building modern technology tools for a $12 trillion industry. So it's happening around us, and I'm going to hand off to Steve now to really dig into kind of the details of this. So I think I set the table with kind of the drivers. Steve's going to talk about the examples of technology in commercial real estate. So I'm going to hand it off to you, Steve.
There you go. No worries. Terrific. Thank you, Brandon. Much better. Good morning. Thanks for having me here. Nice to meet many of you yesterday, and it was a good session. And we'll take a higher view today of real estate technology. Brandon, to your point, I think it's interesting that Uber is the largest transportation company that doesn't really own any assets, and Airbnb is the largest hospitality company, doesn't own anything, doesn't own any real estate. So one doesn't own any cars, one doesn't own any real estate. Pretty fascinating, and if that happens to our industry, it'd be interesting to see how it unfolds. For those of you who were not able to attend yesterday, I'll tell you a little bit about what we talked about yesterday and then go into a deeper dive on where we started. My name's Steve Weichel. I'm from the MIT Center for Real Estate. I'm also the founder of Real Disruption, which is a conference that we started 2 years ago, 24 months ago, right about the time of this flood of new real estate technology. The conference is really takes a look at the intersection of technology and real estate and what that means. And let me just tell you a little bit about the MIT. How many of you know that there's a Center for Real Estate at MIT? Oh, good. You do. I'm glad. It's a little counterintuitive. Sometimes people are surprised that there is, but the center's been around. We just celebrated 31 years. And it's mostly there to do research for the industry. There's also a Master of Science degree that gets delivered from the center. We have an innovation lab, a data, an urban data lab, the media lab, which many of you may have heard of, and a number of other smaller research groups there. There are 1,000 alums in 44 countries. We have 25 partner companies globally. So it's a really great environment to be taking a look at real estate tech. By the way, are there any alums in the audience? Just checking. Every once in a while, I come across ones that I didn't know. So as part of the Real Disruption Initiative and the Real Estate Innovation Lab that we started shifting with a few years ago, our initial look was to identify 200 new ventures that enable the business of commercial real estate. We had to narrow, when we got into it, we found out there were so many, we had to narrow it down. So we narrowed it to commercial. We didn't include crowdfunding. We didn't include multifamily at the time, but now we're moving into that. We didn't include residential, and again, we'll move to that soon. Our list is up over about 400 now, although I've heard that there are well over 2,500 globally real estate tech startups, less than 3 years old generally, mostly bootstrapped, angel, venture funded. So this is a huge flood of these applications coming into the marketplace. To give you a sense of the, as Brandon mentioned, there's a lot of investment going on, and he's been the beneficiary of this. From 2011 to 2013, $200 million in VC went to real estate tech companies, which For a new space, that was a lot of money. $680 million in 2014, and it's expected to be $1.5 billion in 2015. Now, those are global numbers. The U.S. has a large portion of that. But that's just an incredible amount of venture capital going into developing new technologies for commercial real estate. So why is this happening? Brandon mentioned some of it. The question we asked was, why is it happening now? Cloud computing, leaner coding platforms, cheaper, more collaboration tools. We all have mobile devices now that are just incredibly powerful, right in our hands. Also, very interesting, it's not always on the software side, sometimes it's on the hardware side, tremendous high-powered sensing technologies, tiny little sensors, and I'll discuss some of the companies that are using that technology. So we have lower costs, we have software as a service, processing power is getting cheaper, data storage is getting cheaper, the coding formats are getting cheaper. We also have ubiquitous connectivity. So we're pretty much connected everywhere all the time through a variety of means. And importantly, and we'll see this theme through a lot of these startups, big data is getting unlocked, has been unlocked. And then I'm interested in the what I call smaller data, which is highly specialized data that's being gathered along the way as well, or the big data is being parsed into smaller specialized data. And that I'll mention some of those companies. And so why the focus on commercial real estate? Why did this happen now? There was a huge disruption in residential real estate during the dot-com boom, but it's sort of past the commercial. That didn't happen for commercial real estate. Why is it happening now? Well, certainly tech follows the money. We know it's commercial real estate is an enormous industry. The numbers vary, but it's in the trillions of dollars. Also, typically higher transaction value. These are higher margin transactions. Fewer, slower, but higher margin. So there's an attraction for those in the technology industry to see this huge pot of money, or perceived huge pot of money. Also, the Great Recession really forced innovation. People had to find lower cost solutions. They had to do more with less. The industry realizes capturing this data, I think the industry is starting to realize that capturing this data and being able to analyze it and use it to make decisions is really an incredibly powerful tool. And we have data scientists and tech entrepreneurs and data economists. That's kind of a new title that's starting to show up. And in fact, some of the students coming out of the planning school at MIT are going into these areas because planners have worked with data for years, except the tools are much more powerful now. So it's interesting that planners are no longer in municipal offices necessarily. Some of them are going to technology startup companies. And finally, we have this workforce that demands applications and tools that make their work easier, more fun and productive, and as Brandon mentioned, ubiquity of tools that we have in our phone, we have expectations in our workplace that those tools will be equally fun and easy and intuitive to use. So what does all this mean? This means for faster, more accurate tools for decision making, much more data and more transparency, predictive analytics, rather than, you know, economists have always had to look in reverse and analyze what happened. Now they have an opportunity to possibly at least get us to what's happening now and perhaps be able to give us some predictive tools to make decisions. And importantly, and I'm going to talk a little bit about this, these better tools are what attract and retain a high-quality workforce. So for not only for you, but for your occupants and for the companies, your customers and the companies you work with. An interesting data point here, the millennial share of the workforce is now equal to boomers at about 25%, but by 2025, they'll be 45% of the workforce. So we've read a lot about millennials and how they work differently and how they work the same. All of these will have an impact on the workplace and the workspace. So in this database of firms that we have, the first distinction we made was place and then space, pretty much outside the four walls, and then we'll go inside the four walls, and I'll share some of the companies with you. So let's talk about the workplace. There's migration to the largest metros. We've read about that. The southern states and secondary markets are enjoying more of that. However, the data is showing the gross growth in cities is larger than the growth that's happened in the suburbs. However, the total gross amount of the population is really still much bigger in the suburbs. Bottom line is the suburbs aren't going to go away. But what that means is that the millennials, they have a certain, they're looking for a certain thing. We all hear about them finding it in the city, but they may actually find it in the urban burbs, meaning they'll live in the suburbs, but they'll still be looking for this kind of urban experience. So that will impact where they work and how they work. Looking for creative energy, a mix of housing, shopping, offices, culture, and education, that can take place in the suburbs, and it has in a number of cases. And when we look at some of the repurposing of office parks, of 80s office parks or dead shopping malls, very often that's what we see. And I'm sure you've seen it in your markets, creating this kind of live, work, vibrant, maybe not 24/7, maybe not the 24-hour city, but certainly an 18-hour city or a 12-hour city. Preference for walkable communities and car ownership. Now, this data is a little old. Car ownership in 2011 dropped 66%. To 66% from 73% in 2007. That's starting to come back now. That should have the manufacturers a little concerned, and they are. But more importantly, it shows that there's less a focus on driving and more a focus on living. So that will impact where they live, how they live, and where they work, and how they get there. So the first, if we're looking at the workplace, we have to choose a location. So there are a number of really interesting firms. These are what I call the data visualizers. These are the firms that take all of this public data and lay it in. And if you've ever used GIS or you've used any of your mapping tools on your phone, they lay these layers in, and then they lay proprietary data over the top. So there's Create in Washington, D.C. Synthicity has Austin, Texas online. Drive Decisions has Flux has Austin, Texas online. Synthicity was just acquired by Autodesk. Statebook is kind of interesting. They are a a locational tool. So for any of the site location folks that you work with, Statebook has aggregated all of the data that's available from the states and the economic development corporations, and they've overlaid that with demographic data and other GIS data so that you can go to their website and help your companies relocate to any county, city, or state in the country. They also have, what I think is interesting, they've also managed to mine all of the incentive programs that are available in those places. And they have partnerships with the economic development offices. So that's a very powerful tool, and that's a new one that I just came across. Pinpoint is for retail. That's a very powerful retail locational tool, which has foot traffic and locational car traffic, foot traffic, demographic data. So, and Pinpoint has a very elegant user interface. Placemeter, this is a neat one. Brandon, do you know Placemeter? Yeah, these guys started, their premise was, everybody take your phone, you sign up, put your phone in your window and leave the camera on, and we're going to monitor the foot traffic in New York City from your camera, and we'll give you credits so that you can get swag, you can get t-shirts and stuff like that, and coupons for restaurants. And so they were going to aggregate all this data. Now, notwithstanding the security issues, you know, the privacy issues, but what they've done is they pivoted and they've developed really incredible sensors that they place on buildings, outside of buildings. The other thing they have is they're using video recognition, where they place cameras and they're able to track foot traffic and understand how many people are going in and out of stores and what hours of the day. So that's a blend of software, crowdsourcing meaning the camera owners were providing data, and then also hardware. So these are, and you should take a look at them because they have great online demonstrations. So the first thing is you need to find a location, and these will help us find what city, what area of the city we might want to go in, what the transit network looks like. The next thing we wanted, the next category we sort of have is the find and list. So once you decide what part of what town, what state, what part of the town, there are a whole category, and for those of you who were here yesterday, Josh was here from Real Massive. There's some listing platforms, the Square Foot, 42 Floors, Real Massive, Property Fuse. Property Fuse gathers their information from assessor data. See, we have the technology now to go out. We could go out right now and scrape data from public sources. We could go into the assessor's data and scrape all that information, clean it up, and manipulate it, public data, and make certain decisions based on that. They're speeding up the process so that you and I don't have to, because it's pretty tedious. A couple of other interesting ones I thought. Now, these are ones that I use rather than big data. Or actually, I should make the distinction. The Square Foot, 42 Floors, Real Massive, they mostly gather data from users. So they are crowdsourcing listing data from brokers. Property Fuse gathers it from public sources, from the assessor. Opportunity Space and OpSites, these are two interesting sites. These two companies go in and work with municipalities to inventory their assets and their real estate portfolio, because as we know, many cities do not have any idea what they really own. And so they go in and help them organize that, clean it, and then repackage it to make it appealing to developers and real estate people. So they're solving, these are sort of government tools, but they're really helping to make real estate available to developers in a way that developers were never able to access the information. Xceligent, as you may know, is an equivalent to CoStar. These were the various markets that CoStar had to give up in the merger with LoopNet. Who uses Xceligent? Anybody used it? Yeah. So you know what it is. They're very aggressively using data and trying to fill the void. And the last one. Anybody heard of New Dirt? Yeah, a couple of guys know New Dirt. New Dirt is really great. Dave Cattell, he's in Florida. Dave came from. Came from corporate real estate, was I think the head of real estate for Kentucky Fried Chicken, the head of real estate for Ruth's Chris. And so he was frustrated by this idea of getting the brand real estate, heads of real estate for the various brands, mostly restaurants and retail. The relationship, how they sourced real estate according to their profiles. So what he created was Match.com for real estate. It's brilliant. And so if you're a developer, you've got an outlot of X number of, you've got an end cap that's 2,500 square feet, you go in, you enter your data on that, and you press send, and it matches with everybody from CVS, Potbelly, all of the brands that you've heard of and that we see, Subway. They've gone in and they've entered all of the profile for the optimal location for them. You press the button, anybody use match.com? Anyway, so you press the button and it matches and it comes up with a list and then you can click. You guys want to share that with us? No? No, okay. So you click the buttons and it sends communication to the real estate manager saying, hey, I've got this, this, and this. It fits your profile. Let's get together. And so that's just an example of, now Dave's data was gathered very specifically. They went out and physically gathered the data. But that's an example of an application that's highly specific. The data is highly specific. And then there's some public data, some GIS and mapping data and demographic data underneath all of that. So those are examples of finding and listening. Well, now we need to analyze. Oh, by the way, I might mention, I like to always say who we're disrupting. CoStar, LoopNet, and Xceligent might get disrupted by these other players that are coming onto the scene. They're not. We'll talk about that in a moment. They're not going to go away, but they might. They might feel a little pressure. Next, we have to analyze. There are a variety of tools here. Some of you may be familiar with CompStack. They are crowdsourcing lease transaction data, and they've come on the scene very fast. They apparently have 90 or 100% of all of the lease transactions in Manhattan last year, and 80 to 90% of all of them in San Francisco, commercial leases. And this is brokers like yourself entering. This is kind of an interesting model, and this has been used elsewhere. You enter your lease data in on your current leases, and you get a token so that you can then turn around and go into the database and grab information on somebody else's building. Now, we've been doing this for years, and I brokered a little bit too, so we've been doing this for years, and where we've swapped comps. And so this is a platform to swap comps on a more accelerated basis. Then we have Tenant Rex and Rescour. These are also business intelligence platforms for commercial real estate. Reonomy is kind of interesting. Anybody heard of Reonomy? Reonomy's in New York right now, but they're rolling up. Brandon's heard of Reonomy. You click on a building and it drills down and it gives you everything from the stacking plans to who the tenants are to who the owners are. It drills through the financing, the capital stack and the ownership structure, and theoretically drills through any LLCs and finds out who really owns the building and who's really invested in it. So for those of you who are involved in acquisitions, actually for leasing it would be useful too, because it'll be an easy place to find out who's in the building. But also this will be very appealing to acquisitions people. Credify is sort of related to that. They drill down very specifically on mortgage portfolios. This is an analytics tool for understanding mortgage portfolios, again, who owns what and what their condition is and whether they're distressed. So that'll be an interesting one. Remeter, you heard from yesterday, which is a risk analysis tool, risk mitigation tool, basically the FICO for your tenants or the FICO for your operator. It's pretty cool stuff. It's a little overwhelming because there's so much. The difficulty is that there's so much data out there trying to kind of rein it in so that it's not too overwhelming, but definitely worth taking a look at. And the last one, this would be interesting for all of you. Wired, anybody heard of Wired Score? Ah, good, a couple, thank you. Wired Score is Ari Baran-Direct. This is something that came out of the Bloomberg administration. Here was the problem they were having. In New York, encouraging all of these startup companies, putting them into Class B and Class C buildings, and then finding out that these startups, which were generally technology companies, getting to the building and finding out that the connectivity infrastructure was horrible. And so they had to rewire buildings. They had to scramble to get these buildings up to grade. So what the goal was to wire score buildings, a little like LEED except for data connectivity. So now this company has come out and they've gotten tremendous traction, and some really high-level, well-known REITs and portfolios are now wired scoring their buildings. And also, you might have even seen it in CoStar. There is a wired score button in CoStar. And now anybody had any tenants ask specifically for wired score building yet? Okay, that's good to know, and I'll let Ari know. In the same way they are now starting to specify LEED buildings, they will probably start specifying either wired score or some minimum level of connectivity. So that also is an analysis tool that I think is interesting. So now, how do you manage the process and the data? And we've covered some of this. Brandon did a great job of discussing what Hightower does. VTS has a similar platform. Lease Pipeline is a lease process management tool. Some of you may have heard of that. And were they here yesterday? I think they're... Oh, no, it was ProposalNet that was here yesterday. ProposalNet helps you manage proposals. So these are tools to help the process and streamline the process. And of course, we're fortunate to have Brandon here because he's an expert at that and has been down that road pretty far already. So that's the workplace. That's where how we're going to find the place where we want to locate somebody, where we want to put an occupier. Let's talk about the workspace for this particular workforce, because this workforce is really going to influence. What the research has found, actually, is that millennials don't, what they want in a workplace is not much different from Gen X and boomers. And the collaboration quotient is roughly equal. This was from the CBRE Workplace Strategy Group report. They require less face-to-face and more individual focus time. They require more space to think, meet, and collaborate and learn, clearly more space for socializing. And a lot of work gets done in the socializing environment. But there is a demand for seamless technology inside and outside and around the office. Importantly, what this study found was that workers generally spend less than 50% of the time at their desk. So that's interesting. You've got a very expensive building with very expensive infrastructure, and the workers are only at their desk 50% of the time, so the asset arguably is 50% underutilized. So what's that mean? We'll come back to that in a moment. It does mean that occupiers are starting to innovate. CBRE did a workplace, their Workplace 360 program, which some of you may have been involved in. State Street Bank in Boston did an interesting project where they reduced the costs per seat by 35%. They saved $2.6 million per year. They reduced the square foot per seat by 36%, from 170 to 108 square feet. That's a dramatic drop. That has huge financial implications. Now, there is a recent study that came out of maybe University of New South Wales that's starting to point, for all of this talk about scaling down and hot desking and hoteling and people using less space, that there is some question in certain industries and certain types of companies that the productivity does not necessarily go up. These cases, they notice increased productivity and decreased cost. But we'll find out over time whether that works in all situations. So what do we do inside the four walls? Some really neat companies doing work there. They overlap. Their workflows and traffic, Refinity and Motion Loft do workflow and traffic and space optimization. They do it with sensors. They monitor the pings on Wi-Fi. They map all of the activity and how people move around inside the four walls and help to optimize how that gets set up. So do you add a desk? Do you take a desk away? Do you put the printer 10 yards down the hall? They can really drill down into this stuff. Again, the privacy issue is a little of a concern, perhaps, but generally speaking, they're optimizing this incredibly valuable asset to get full value out of it. Robin does some work in does some work in retail. Trampoline Systems is interesting. This is a company that is in the UK. We mostly have looked at the US, but this one was so compelling, I put it on the list anyway. Trampoline maps the maps the employees, the entire interaction of employees. And so you get these incredible visual tools to be able to look at what the relations are within the organism, the company organism. But what's more interesting is when they went outside the four walls, and their premise was, let's see, if Uber is going, gets a spike in drops at 2:30 in the morning on a Saturday morning in an area of West London that we thought was abandoned where nobody lives, what's going on there? And it allows you to go out and find out, is it pop-up, is it raves, parties, gallery openings, what's going on there? And that allows a planning department and then real estate people to determine, do we want to be where the action is, or do we want to actually avoid and have our clients avoid the action? So MIT is working on a new tool right now that allows you to predict where the next gentrification is going to take place. Very, very interesting. Has interesting implications. And Retail Next also is one of those tools. Actually, Robin, I made a mistake. Robin is a scheduling tool that allows you to schedule meeting rooms in the office. Sorry about that. I get a few of these confused. We've only got 400 of them plus. This one I think is interesting, the sharing economy, and you've heard about these, and we know about Airbnb, we know about Uber, we've probably used it. The sharing platforms within real estate. This is collaborative consumption to improve asset utilization and spread costs. So this is Zipcar, Airbnb, Uber. The disruptors, I've got some of them listed here, and then we'll talk about who's disrupted. WeWork is in Chicago, right? Is WeWork in Chicago yet? Yeah, that's what I thought. They're in Chicago. They might have multiple locations. I know you have other co-working spaces. Co-working is really an interesting model. WeWork is now the fifth largest tenant, office tenant, in New York City. Fifth largest. This is crazy. They're huge. They're in 44 cities, 44 countries. 40 countries. So this will have tremendous impacts. These are short-term leases. The companies can grow and shrink. So that will have a big impact on what brokers do in the space. Anybody use Pivot Desk here in your market? Anybody use Pivot Desk yet? Pivot Desk is Zipcar or Uber for empty desks. So you have a law firm occupant. They've either taken on more space so they can expand, or they've had a reduction. They have extra desks on one end of the floor. Pivot Desk allows me to go on my phone and book, or online, on my phone and book those desks temporarily by the month, or by the 6 months, or by the year. Short-term lease, I go in, I use these desks that were empty, and it gets monetized, and there's a split deal between Pivot Desk and the, so it's, they're basically managing subleases. But they're not managing subleases that are long-term leases, they're managing subleases that are month-to-month, and quarter-to-quarter, and year-to-year. So, as you might imagine, that may have implications on how leasing gets done. Liquid space, same thing, but for meeting rooms. So you have this law firm has downsized, and they have, sorry to pick on law firms, but law firms, they've downsized, and they have extra meeting rooms. And I can go in and I can book on the phone from the plane and arrive 30 minutes later and book that meeting room for an hour. And if I have other people coming in, we can all meet there. So again, this is unlocking the value of the unused space. Liquid Space has now also cut a deal with Marriott, and they're helping to manage Marriott's empty meeting room space. Storefront is a platform for pop-up stores for retail. So you have retail space, it's open, you have no long-term leases there. You list it on Storefront, and some new company wants to do a pop-up store for a month or a couple of weeks or a couple of months, and this is a clearinghouse for pop-up space for retail. Breather's out of Canada, but they have quite a presence in New York, and they're rolling out in the U.S. They take a little different approach. They really are the Zipcar version, where Zipcar owns the car, Uber doesn't own the car. Breather takes the lease on the space and makes it available to you by the hour. They call it chill space. And it's by the hour, and the founder, his complaint was, I can't take my shoes off at Starbucks when I'm having meetings, and I sometimes can't hear. So let's do a little 500 square foot place with a table and a couch and some nice artwork that's comfortable, and you can rent it by the hour, and people can come in and do readings for plays in New York. You can come in and have business meetings. You can they have fashion people come in and do trunk shows. So it's an interesting way to optimize those smaller spaces in buildings, and they're also partnering with the landlords to provide a platform for doing that. So those are the sharing, those in the sharing economy. Who will be disrupted? Regis, to some level. Leasing brokers, potentially, and I'll talk about that for a moment. By the way, I don't pick winners, I just deliver the information. but I'll tell you how. We'll talk about that in a moment. And then lawyers. And I won't apologize there, because there are no lawyers in the room. So, so what's next? Looking out a little further, virtual and augmented reality. So you heard from Matt yesterday, those of you who were there, Real Link is a tool to do walkthroughs while your clients sit at the desk. You do this on your cell phone, you narrate a walkthrough, they don't have to leave their office. What happens when Real Link crosses over with Oculus, which is the headset that Google bought, right? Yeah. What happens when, Real 5D is a platform for 5D, pretty much virtual gaming scale technology. So combine all, and frankly, I don't even know what 5D is, but combining all three of these, Florida is a 3D tool, combine all three or four of these, and so just imagine you've got your primary client is in Dallas. The building is in Hong Kong, your architect is in Seattle, you're in New York, and your money guys are in London. And right now, we're to the point where they can get on their monitor, but what if they put the Oculus on, and they actually walk through a tour of the building with you, narrated, like you're all in the same room. And not just the space, but you go up and down the elevators, you walk through the lobby, you walk around the neighborhood, and then lay that over with some of these digital visualization tools that we discussed earlier, where you get a sense of what's happening in the neighborhood. And this is some pretty powerful stuff. I don't know when this will happen, but it's not far off. Cubed cities, write this one down, because this is really interesting. And I was going to show a demo, but I it didn't really show up well here. Cubed cities is a 3D virtualization tool that, and it's great, they've got a broker version. It's in Canada. It shows the stacking plans and shows where the lease availability is in each of the buildings. So you get this 3D view of the city, and it flies you around the city, and you can see which towers and which spaces, they're identified by color as to what type of space is available. It'll show this floor, that floor, this retail space. But what's really neat about it is that you can pick and choose, if you have your own listings, you can actually edit a flyby tour of the city with just your, say, three listings. So, and you can send that to your client. So you can send it to the client and say, hey, you're going to get in a helicopter virtually, and you're going to fly around in this city where, and these are the spaces I've identified for you. Tell me what you think. And it's really, really cool stuff. Young company, just starting to get developed, getting some traction, but just for the wow factor alone. But they're very specifically helping brokers solve those kinds of problems on site visits. So those are ones to watch. And then there are the big data gorillas that we can't ignore them. CoStar, the $200 million apartments.com acquisition, gives them tremendous amounts of data. They're moving into the multifamily space. Zillow and Trulia merger, what happens when they start, and they've already started it, unlocking the data that they have. Redfin Builder Services is an interesting example. Redfin, if you're familiar, anybody familiar with Redfin? It's been around, has been around since the .com. They initially were going to disrupt residential brokers. They were going to cut commissions and do flat fees. They still do that, but they've sort of pivoted. Big company, well-funded. Builder Services, the difference between Redfin and Zillow and Trulia is that Redfin has the they actually hire data, hire brokers. Their brokers are their employees, and they're salaried, they're not commissioned. And so they are incentivized by entering the data on their transactions. So now you have this 15 years of search data on the website, understanding how people are searching. And by the way, this is residential, but it's only a matter of time before it goes to commercial. They've got 15 years of data on how people are searching, what they're searching for, where they're searching for it, but they've got all of the transaction data on the sales. Zillow and Trulia have to sort of connect the dots between the MLS systems, which is not bad, but the MLS systems are not always accurate. And so what happens when you have the search data and the transactional data, now you can model what it is people were looking for versus what it is that they settled for or what they bought. And it will allow developers to determine, and this is what they're proposing, and I think they're close to it, that they'll be able to determine what to build, where to build, and when to build it. That could be very powerful. Auction.com, with a $50 million Google investment, Auction.com, I think they've got all this incredible amount of data. I don't quite know what that will mean, but eventually they'll start unlocking it and using it. And then there are the consumer tools that we shouldn't underestimate them. Waze, if you use Waze, Uber, Facebook, Google, Airbnb, again, they're gathering all of this data, and it could all be used for a variety of industries, but certainly certainly commercial real estate. And just as an example from Robert Benchley from University of Miami, Walmart now generates enough data to fill 60 million five-drawer file cabinets every hour. I mean, that's just makes your head explode. It's just too much. And I think the challenge will probably be how to make use of it. There's so much. Fine to have all this data. The question is, will we have the tools to make use of it, and will it help us do our jobs any better? I think we're proving that, yes, it is, but we'll see what happens in the future. So what are the key takeaways? As I just said, significantly more data, better transparency, more powerful analytics and predictive decision-making tools, decreased transactional friction, and traditional brokers and advisors and consultants will pivot. There may be I said I'd come back to this. There may be reduced margins there may be reduced margins on a per transaction basis. This is what happened in residential. Initially, there was the threat that commissions were going to go down, and we know that they actually are right back where they were, and in some markets are higher in residential. But what will happen is, instead of taking 3 months to negotiate a lease deal, it'll take 3 weeks. I'm making this up, but you know, we could have this order of magnitude kind of reduction in the process. So you'll do many, many more transactions at a lower cost, and therefore it'll either be a neutral or, in fact, might even be more profitable. It will also allow brokers and other people in the industry to have a competitive edge. If you have the best tools that are faster and cheaper and smarter, it will allow you to attract more business as well. And no form of real estate is exempt from the exponential expansion of technology. That was from the Emerging Trends 2015 report that we just heard at ULI this week, a few days ago. And with that, I will thank you. I know we covered a lot of territory, so I'm glad to take questions. And Brandon's here to answer some questions as well. So please, do we have we may have a mic, either that. Oh, yes, we do have a mic. Or I'll just repeat the question. Sure.
So with all those startups disrupting, not all of them will make it. Not all of them will survive. Change is fast and getting faster. How does a room full of people like this make a good bet for ourselves, our companies, our clients, on any of those disruptors insightfully and right more than wrong?
Yeah. That's a great question. The question was, given that all of these are startup companies, they're young, how do you choose which ones to use so that you don't find out that in 18 months something vaporized that puts you in a bad position, it puts your client in a bad position? I don't have an answer for that, but it's already starting to happen. 42 Floors has had a sort of a reorganization. Brandon, are there some other ones that have pivoted or reorganized? Yeah,
the explosion of
Right. Yeah, and I think the safe bet would be, so the as in case you couldn't hear, Brandon, there's been consolidation. Some have reorganized. Some of them have actually gone away in a short amount of time. The key thing is to read up on them, meet with them, make sure that they're well-funded, find out the quality of their funding. And if they're acquired, that's not necessarily a bad thing. And then maybe... for instance, RealLink, I had a conversation earlier with somebody about RealLink, young startup company, unclear whether they might some bigger competitor might come along and either push them out of the way or gobble them up. But that's kind of a low risk tool for you because it's a monthly or a yearly membership cost. And so that I would choose them carefully on who they are and how well funded they are.
Maybe your MIT data analytics lab can come up with some sort of liability index.
We are
liability or prediction of who's really gotten what time.
That's the work that's being done right now. We're trying to map the real estate startup ecosystem and understand where the money came from, where the founders came from. The companies that have been acquired, the ones that have been have survived, and in fact, we're still pretty young, and there are only a few of them have not made it, because you can generally make it through 18 months or 24 months. So, but to your point, that's part of the research that's being done at MIT, so that we can in turn present that to the industry to get a better guide. And there are people who write about the ones that they think are the more stable and not, but. It was hard to tell if you put your money on Facebook, you were good. If you put your money on MySpace, you were out of luck. So anyway, I'm sorry I didn't have a better answer for you, but yes, sir.
Two questions. So we have the travel industry with Orbitz and Expedia knocking out the travel agents. The question is, what happens to the real estate brokers in this room 3 to 5 years from now? And then the second question is, lots of my clients, I'm sure people in this room are getting calls every single day by prospects of LoopNet. And what's that? How is that going to evolve? The LoopNet, which is called the free and all that.
Right. Two questions. You get a lot of calls through LoopNet, so how will that play out? And the other question was Orbitz and Expedia pretty much wiped out travel agents. Interesting. I'll speak about the travel agents first. There are still travel agents around, and in fact, in Boston, the founder of Kayak, Paul English, just announced a new venture of a boutique travel agency. Here's a guy who sold Kayak, which was one of those competitors, sold Kayak for hundreds of millions of dollars, and he has now carved out an area. He feels that there's an area of the industry that is demanding the kind of personal contact and personal attention that went away when travel agents went away. Interesting that it's coming full circle. You have Silver Car, which is all silver Audis rented at airports, white glove service, very high-end kind of approach. So I think how this relates, and Brandon will have a comment too.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Commercial brokers are never going away. Yeah. Yeah, come on up. I should have given him a microphone.
No, I think this is a really important point. So I think I deeply believe that commercial real estate brokers and brokerage is not going anywhere anytime soon. We're talking very, very long time. So before I got into commercial real estate, I spent 6 years at CBRE as a broker. Before that, I was at a company called Zillow. And everyone thought that Zillow and Redfin were going to disrupt the residential real estate broker. And I talked about this yesterday, but it's a super important stat. So people were, National Association of Realtors were trying to do everything to just like eliminate Zillow. Now, fast forward to today. You know, Zillow is a $5.5 billion company, publicly traded, completely changed the residential real estate industry. You know, home buyers and sellers get a bunch of data online. They do a bunch of their own homework. and then they hire a real estate agent. So there are more residential real estate agents today than there were the day that Zillow started. Now let's talk about commissions, right? Because that's the next thing that we think about. Well, gosh, you know, commission compression, now we're getting paid a fraction of that. The residential real estate commission today is about identical in terms of percentage, although housing prices have gone up, so they're making more per sale, as it was 8 to 10 years ago. So nothing has changed. And so now let's think about commercial real estate. I believe deeply that the commercial real estate transaction is much more complex than a residential real estate sale. I believe that deeply. I think everyone would agree. Corporate real estate, institutional sales, and it's a business-to-business transaction. We're dealing with professionals on all sides: seller, buyer, appraiser, architect. So the nature of our role is going to change. It's going to change, I think, in a very good way, meaning we're going to spend less time doing brain damage, low-value work, and we're going to have tools that let us focus on more strategic work. The residential real estate agent today spends less time opening doors, driving people around in cars, but they have to be better at transacting. They have to be better at negotiating a term sheet. They have to be better at marketing property. They have to be better at project managing the process. If we're not good at that as brokers, we will be disrupted by the brokers who leverage tools and use that and do that kind of work. So that's my point of view on that. And this is coming from ex-software engineer turned broker turned now, you know, founder of Hightower Building Technology. So that's my point of view.
Don't go away. Stay up here. Okay. That's good. Good. And there was a second question. The LoopNet question. Can you speak to that, Brandon?
Yeah, I can take that mic if you want. Yeah. I'll just sit down. So I think one of the great pains in our ass is the fact that we have to spend a ton of money for data that in every other industry is free, right? The multiple listing service, of, you know, are there any LoopNet people in here? Okay, so it's deeply frustrating. So our industry is one of the last major industries where the data set around what is available and how much does it cost costs us money as professionals and as end users to figure out the answer to those questions. That is one of the great opportunities for this next wave of technology to disrupt. You want to talk about things that are ready for disruption? It's that concept. So I think the question around, well, what happens to a LoopNet and to a CoStar? I think there's going to be pressure over the next couple of years on making that cheaper for all of us. I shouldn't have to pay a bunch of money to be on the showcase listing just to get, like, you know, 50% of the people to actually see my listing. Like, that's a problem. So we've seen that on the residential side, changed a lot. And I think that's going to change over the next couple of years as we start opening up some of these data sets.
And frankly, this idea of giving them your money for free and then they package it and turn around and sell it back to you, that model can't. And this is why people jump into the space, like Real Massive and some of the other startups are jumping into this space. And so I would urge you to take a look at those, because a lot of that data is crowdsourced. They're asking you to get involved and enter your data so that, and I'm not suggesting we all gang up on CoStar, because they actually have an immense amount of useful data, and that will continue to be useful. But Yeah.
There we go. Okay. So, I think to his point, it's one of the biggest challenges there is that all of the data is coming directly from brokers. So, you know, CoStar's cold calling you on a day-to-day basis, trying to get listings updated. You were talking about, someone mentioned LoopNet. You were talking about the LoopNet guys. So that is actually a very hard thing to change, because you can't move that at scale. So I think there's just going to be, I think CoStar and LoopNet are going to recognize that, you know, that we're not going to pay that much money and give up that data and then buy it back again for a long time. So, you know, I think that there's a lot of people in the business of trying to make that a cheaper service for everyone.
That's great. Thanks, Brandon. Other questions? Yes. Brent, the question was, how do we see convergence of the technology? Presumably, possibly, Scott, that we'd have one mega app that everybody would use? That kind of convergence? Brandon, maybe you can speak to that, because you have experienced this in the very short amount of time, going from how you've spread the functionality and made a more robust platform.
I mean, I think there are a few realities. None of us want 25 logins to 25 different systems, and we've forgotten the passwords on all of them. It's just terrible, right? So there's, I think, a strong pressure from our customers to say, I want a single platform, or at least multiple platforms that talk to each other that I can access, you know, via one interface. Yeah. So that's going to happen. So all of the logos that you saw up there are being built on a set of open APIs that allow us to communicate and push data back and forth. Hightower has integrated with Floored now. So if you're a Hightower customer and a Floored customer, you get 3D tours delivered right to your Hightower iPhone app. It's really cool stuff. And we're going to be announcing some other ones. We've done integrations with MRI, Yardi, JD Edwards, so all that data flows. And what I think is really exciting is that all of the really amazing kind of like, you know, technological leaps in an industry happen at the intersection points of those dots. Not just like individual silos of technology, they happen when you combine market data with availabilities data, with mobility, with like three or four systems. So that's, you know, we're kind of all the modern technology companies are going there, and I think that's where we're going to see some really cool stuff.
When it gets connected, it accelerates. Yes, sir, in the back. The question was, do we think, by the way, I have no inside knowledge, but the question was, do we think CoStar will make acquisitions of some of these? Possible. I think any company who might see an opportunity to jump the line and acquire other technology, but I think we've seen history in other industries where that is very difficult to do when you have an established company that tries to accelerate innovation, and it doesn't always turn out well. Sometimes it does turn out well. Do you have a perspective on that?
I mean, so Xceligent was the result of an FTC consent decree to CoStar that was around antitrust implications of the CoStar acquisition of LoopNet. So Xceligent actually got spun out of CoStar because they were mandated to create a quote unquote competitor. That's how Xceligent exists. That's why it's out there. CoStar also sued Real Massive very publicly recently. So you guys could Google that, CoStar lawsuit Real Massive. So they have a history of acquiring companies. I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, they're trying to do similar things there. We're kind of already seeing it. So.
Yes, Gary. Gary's question was, what's it cost? Because that's really what it comes down to, what it costs versus what benefit it provides to you. There are a number of different models. Some of them are free models to brokers. Comstack is free to brokers. Real Massive is free to brokers. There's a freemium model, which is free to a certain level, and then you get an upgrade. That's a little like LinkedIn and other applications that you might use in the consumer space. Some of them, on the other hand, are enterprise-wide contracts for big offices. It's either on a per seat basis, meaning you're buying licenses, so it's either on a per seat basis or an office basis or an enterprise-wide basis. So each of them are a little bit different. Brandon, how are you set up now?
We're a subscription service, similar to, you know, if you were buying the LinkedIn premium, you know, monthly service. So it's a per user per month basis. I think that the nice thing about cost, because, you know, there were a ton of tools out there. So what would be the cost if I got all those tools? Is they're just completely different models to make money today than kind of traditionally. So the models that he talked about. So there are a lot of those tools that are actually totally free to brokers, because brokers are providing a service. You guys are putting your supply into a platform that demand can go find. And the cost structure, so how much it costs a company like Hightower to build Hightower has probably gone down about 100x in the last 10 years. I can build a heck of a lot more software, a heck of a lot faster than I could 10 years ago because of the technologies that we have to bear. So as a result, you guys can buy a Hightower platform for a tiny fraction fraction of what it costs to buy a CoStar platform or something else. So the costs are generally a lot lower. The other big thing, so how many of you guys are paying for LinkedIn, like have a subscription that's more than just the free one so you can go find contact information and do stuff? Okay. If you're not and you're in brokerage, you should do that tomorrow, first of all. It's insanely powerful at exposing the real connections in your network. But anyway, the point I was going to make is that new software companies, we have to do a completely different model for selling software to you because all of the power is in your hands. You guys can switch. We're a subscription service. I'm not deploying any software to your laptops. You guys literally just log in. And so you've got a lot more flexibility to try software. So you can pilot software. You get a 3-month trial. You can kick the tires. You can see if it works for you. If it doesn't, you can kick it to the curb, and you're not in a bunch of money. You're not out of pocket. So that is, most of these software vendors or technology companies, that's the model because they recognize you guys all have the exact same question. It's like, what if you guys go bankrupt? What if it doesn't work? I don't want to be spending $1,000 on something that doesn't work. So you get trials.
Yeah, and some of them, LinkedIn's $19 a month, but some of them are free, some of them are $25 a month, $25 a quarter. And it also, I think some of the more specialized programs, Remeter, for example, is a different kind of a model because, and it's therefore slightly more expensive. Simply because the inputs are more expensive. So depending upon what the application is would determine what the cost is. But to Brandon's point, when it's software as a service, you've got a subscription model, use it for a month, use it for 3 months. If it worked, great. If it didn't, move on to the competitor, see what they look like for those that have that kind of setup. Yes, sir. Yeah, the question was if you've already maybe built a simple application that's made your life easier, that it wasn't already out in the workplace, what are the steps to possibly turning that into something? Patent, trademark, copyright. But other than that, Brandon, do you want to speak to that? How did the idea gestate and how did you, when you were a person of an employee of one, how did you get to an employee of two or three?
So to answer your question quickly, there are a lot of application developers that you can hire to help build you a prototype. And like I said, you know the cost of doing that has dropped dramatically, exponentially. So you can actually get a prototype of your idea off the ground fairly quickly, fairly cost effectively. There are websites like Elance or Odesk, which will connect you to developers. So, and then you know, I was at CBRE getting increasingly frustrated with the lack of tool set that I had, my clients had, and getting more inspired about the opportunity to move the industry forward. And that was going on for about a year and a half before I left CBRE to start the company. And then I joined up with my CTO and our chief product officer to get it off the ground. So.
And it happens a variety of different ways, but you could certainly find out, Jim, you're out in California, right? Find out, you've got a lot of tech talent there because of the media business in Southern California. There are various groups that meet. You've got lots of institutional support, USC, UCLA, Cal Poly, and others. And that's what happens at MIT. I have people walk through my door, hey, I've got an idea. I've got one, it's called EnerScore, which is a FICA for home energy efficiency. And they showed it to me, and I brought a bunch of some of our engineers and data analysis analysts, and we sat down, and their mouths were open because it was so cool. What was better is that the kid is 17 years old. I mean, it's amazing, and he's written all these algorithms. It's just really cool. So, fortunately, I'm at a place that people come to. But you could certainly give me a call. I'm sure Brandon would be glad to give you some guidance for anybody who has any ideas, because this is how the stuff gets created. People like you see a problem, say, "Gee, I wish I could do this." Take a look and find out that it's not out there. And because coding has gotten less expensive, you can find people who freelance. You can do a rudimentary app to see if it really works, and it doesn't take much to do it. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
If you were looking to just kind of stay up on some of this stuff, so I'm taking pictures while
right.
I'll go back and look it up. I follow MIT Center for Commercial Real Estate through Facebook, and I get online and humor, so watching USC
It's interesting, there isn't a lot of peer review yet. This space is going to be so big, I'm surprised that, and Brandon, I don't know if you know of it, normally we would expect Forrester or Gartner or one of the software analysts to start following it in a big way, but for some reason, not yet. Have you seen it? Yeah, where does the category fit? So, sorry.
Yeah, Gartner and Forrester have called us trying to figure out where this category of software lives, but not really yet. So there's a website called CRETechIntersect.com, which is exactly that. So it's a bunch of CRE tech companies, and they actually have a conference. So that's pretty good. But I think that, that's why these conversations are so important, because you guys are asking good questions, and then there's feedback. So I think what is needed is the industry discourse on it, so that you can talk about the software that worked, and then you can talk about the one that didn't. You guys can share best practices. And that really hasn't happened yet. And I think, this is an example of it starting to happen. So 3 years ago, the notion of having a technology conversation in a big room with all of you, I think probably wouldn't have made much sense at SIOR, and now it makes a heck of a lot more sense. So we're seeing it kind of hit the mainstream.
And
which is
we've been having some discussions about maybe it's SIOR who can take the lead on some of this for its members to really help navigate this environment. And at the same time, even at MIT, we're still navigating it. This research is quite new, and we're just starting to go dive into it and get a better understanding of what's really going on. So, other questions? Yes, please. The first mic user, thank you.
And actually kind of maybe give something as a reassurance. So I'm here as a guest, and I'm a corporate end user, and I'm sitting here looking at all of this stuff. I've got a day job. So I'm just giving you guys some reassurance. I've got to talk to my clients internally. I've got to understand my company, what I'm doing on a day-to-day basis. I've got to effectively manage my portfolio. I don't have time to understand Oculus Rift or this software or that software or something like that. But if somebody's going to utilize a tool and that's going to help me save time and deliver a better product to my internal clients, God bless you guys for learning that stuff.
No, that's great. Thank you. Thank you for the nice. I'm glad we have a client here. Thank you. No, this is good to hear, because the client will, as much as we are, and we're guilty of this at MIT, we get enamored by the technology. Some of the companies, the startups I meet with, I have to remind them that this is a really, really cool solution looking for a problem to solve. And that happens sometimes with startups. So, but this is great from an occupier standpoint. I think the adoption, although in our world the adoption seems pretty quick, I think in your world the adoption will probably be very measured. And so, even though I've thrown 30 or 40 of these up here, have you used Refinity at all yet? Okay. Well, there are some great tools, and it will be because we're doing a little bit of work with Cornet now too on some research, and so Cornet may identify the one or two or three small bites. SIOR may identify for its members the one or two or three small bites, and then it will begin to expand.
To me, that's like one of the greatest opportunities here is the SIOR, the Cornet, the ULIs, to share thought leadership internally and say, these are the things that actually work, for us, by us, like people who are implementing them, talking about them. There's a question there.
I'll be right there. The other thing you can take a look at, and again, it gets pretty techy, but you can look at Crunchbase and you can look at AngelList, and that'll list 100, because we use that as a resource to track what are the new companies, who's getting funded. But it will still be hard to distinguish which ones are for real. What are they really? Are they just an idea, or are they a real company? That's our job. But if you're interested in this stuff, that's also a good resource. Yes, sir. The question is, why was residential so quick, so more ready to adapt? I'll try to answer that. Brandon will have a thought on that. I don't know that they were ready to adapt to it, but maybe it was lower hanging fruit. You've got MLS already had all of this data available, and there were battles between MLS and whether they were going to, the multiple listing services, whether they were going to partner with these .com, these rogue .com startups. And I don't know, I'm not privy to how those first MLSs got on board. I don't know what that negotiation looked like because the brokers owned the data. Does that sound familiar? The brokers owned the data in their MLS systems, but there was an MLS. So there were huge amounts of data. And I think they came to the conclusion that we could, that they could monetize it. And then once the genie was out of the bottle, then and there were other benefits to it. My sense is that. I don't know the real story. Brandon, do you have a thought on that?
Yeah. I mean, it starts with data. So MLS was effectively a not-for-profit across the country data source, right? So smart companies like Redfin, I remember when Redfin first came out, I was in Seattle. They had access to Northwest MLS, and they were mapping properties. It was an amazing thing. They didn't have to do the first thing, which we would all have to do in the commercial real estate space, which is call every broker and say, hey, can you guys send me the data so I can map it and make it free instead of $400 a month? That's the problem facing the commercial real estate equivalent of that. And that's why, you know, and that's why the big data, you know, CoStar is such a big 500-pound gorilla, because the data set has not been captured or consolidated. The second thing is residential is such a consumer, it's more of a consumer problem. So commercial real estate is just a lot more complex. Like, it's just the deal structures are more complex, the actors are more complex. So it takes a much deeper domain expertise to build technology that doesn't suck. And like, if you think about it, like, a lot of technology people could consider themselves consumers of residential technology. They're like, I've bought a house before and that stinks, right? Most of these guys building technology who have not spent years in the industry have no idea what it's like to negotiate a 12-year transaction. So they just can't build it. So they might try, but usually they just don't care, right? So there's like these two concentric circles, like commercial real estate and technology, and they almost don't overlap at all in terms of people, right? And so that's kind of one of the other reasons. So now you've got this new wave of folks who have some domain expertise, have built software before, and now are trying to bring that to our industry.
Yeah, and that's a great point that almost every technology person has bought a house and knows how miserable it was, but not every technology person has negotiated a lease and known how tough that can be. So that's a great point. Other questions? Yes, sir. One more. We, as when we do our research, or how would you get to know them? Yeah. How do you connect with them? I'm sure they will all return your email. I promise you. At MIT, what we do is we're busy scanning and trying to gather, and then we have researchers. Or when I'm assembling a panel, I reach out to people directly. And frankly, it's MIT, so they're usually pretty good about returning calls. So I'm lucky in that respect. But also, you're the customers they want, or they want to get to your customers. So. It will take a little time to sort through, and I'm glad to, SIR will either post or distribute this these slides. That gives you a little bit of a start. And I've identified pretty much the major players in those categories. There are a lot of specialty apps and young startups that may or may not make it. Our list is much broader. So we can post this. You can always shoot me an email. Go to CRE Tech. CRE Tech is Pierce Neinken is a CBRE guy from the West Coast who right? CBRE. Did you work with him? Yeah, same company. Pierce has a great event that he does twice a year, East Coast, West Coast. It is a larger version of Real Disruption. Real Disruption that we do in Boston tends to be a little bit more academic. We approach it a little bit more differently. He does a showcase for real estate technology. just going to the website and taking a look at who his speakers and exhibitors are will give you a great list, and frankly, I've used the list. So, because he uncovers people that I haven't yet uncovered. So that's a good resource to find out technologies that are out there. And you can always shoot me an email message and the slides will be posted. And with that, I'll say thank you very much. Before you go, I meant to thank Jim Boudreau, Tom Farrelly, Don Mancini, and Tim Brodigan from the New England group, SIOR, who were kind enough to have me into their breakfast and get me here. The committee for this event, John Adams, Gary Shacker, Jim Klein, Steve Kapp, and then SIOR, Allison Stull, and Lizzie Loken, who really makes all of this work. So I really appreciate it, and thank you.